Welcome to The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter. We are committed to bringing you the day's most important news and current affairs stories from an LGBTI perspective. If it matters to the LGBTI community, we will cover it. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS 0427 Joy 949 or email onair@joy.org.au or follow us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
It's Tuesday the 1st of August. Welcome to The Informer. I'm your host, Lara Dickinson.
And I'm Ian Muchmore.
This morning, the Human Rights Commission released their Change the Course report on sexual harassment and assault in universities. The findings of the survey may be upsetting or triggering for some of our listeners, and if that occurs, remember that there are a number of support services you can contact, including Beyond Blue, 1-800-RESPECT and Switchboard. The Commission conducted a study of over 30,000 students from 39 universities.
The study found that 51% of students report being sexually harassed, 7% report being sexually assaulted. This study shows that women, members of the LGBTQIA community, especially trans and gender diverse people, Indigenous students and students with disabilities are at highest risk. And worryingly, 94% of sexual harassment and 87% of sexual assaults at university go unreported.
The National Union of Students has welcomed the report. The Informer's Colin Tyrus is speaking with the NUS President, Sophie Johnston.
If you could use one word to describe your reaction to today's Change the Course report, what would that be?
Probably shocking or heartbreaking. What we've seen come out of the results today, they're not anything that we didn't expect, but, you know, to actually hear the stories and to be able to put a face to the survivors is a very, very emotional experience. It's very confronting, especially seeing as this issue has been really, you know, underplayed and not talked about for decades and decades. So to see it finally come to surface is a very, very confronting thing to experience.
Why do you think sexual assault and harassment was so underreported on campus?
Universities haven't had adequate reporting systems ever before 2016. Generally, no university had standalone reporting systems, but it goes much deeper than that. The actual repercussions for perpetrators basically hasn't existed at all. There have been cases where students have reported and the perpetrators have been promoted to more senior positions in academics or in the colleges and been given support and counselling, whereas the victim has basically been left alone. So those really, really negative stories from survivors has probably deterred a significant amount of people from speaking out.
Well, how do we create environments where victims can be secure in knowing they'll be taken seriously when there's so much in our culture and media and society that undermines and ignores victims?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's the starting point is for universities to come out and say they're going to bring in support programs and preventions. But going deeper than that, they really need to make clear to perpetrators exactly what will happen if you commit these kind of crimes, because they are crimes. And I think they need to make that very, very, very clear.
The Australian Human Rights Commission has called for a change in culture as a result of the findings of the report. What do you say to that?
Well, I think, you know, this isn't just a university problem. This is a society problem, a cultural problem where our attitudes towards certain genders and sexualities really aren't adequate at all enough. And they do create these environments where these behaviours do manifest. Within the universities, though, these are very integrated communities with very diverse groups of people, some fresh out of high school. And that environment does create a place where these behaviours manifest in a more intricate kind of way. So universities absolutely have the responsibility to tackle this head on.
It's amazing to think that 1 in 5 or 21% of students were sexually harassed either on campus, at an off-campus event organised by the uni, at a university employment opportunity, or some of all of the perpetrators were students, teachers or other people associated with the university.
Yeah, absolutely. And you think of those numbers and that's just for 2016. Imagine, you know, student unions and women's officers have been campaigning on this issue for decades. So this has painted a picture of 1 year of experiences. Imagine the countless tens of thousands of victims who have, you know, gone unheard for so long and finally today really have been able to get some kind of recognition and some kind of a voice on something that, you know, really hasn't been recognised ever before.
How do we change attitudes around women? Because you notice in the findings that women were almost twice as likely as men to have been sexually harassed in a university setting.
I think this issue starts much, much earlier than universities. And like I say, it is a cultural problem. Our sexual education that we're providing to young people is seriously inadequate from primary school right throughout high school. There's next to nothing on consent training, understanding respect for relationships, understanding gendered violence, which is a significant issue. I think until we really start to educate from a very, very early age, these attitudes and behaviours won't be combated.
I noticed that trans and gender diverse students were more likely to have been sexually harassed at uni. Are university administrations doing enough to look after the LGBTIQ community?
Well, no, they haven't. The stats are very serious for LGBTI students. 44% of people who identified as bisexual had experienced sexual harassment, which is one of the most significant figures that came out of the report. There was also trans and gender diverse students that were more likely to be harassed than anyone. So it does speak to a lack of support for the LGBTI community and a serious need to address that group of students and make sure that they are getting the support that they deserve and that perpetrators are being dealt with.
The report still mentions that alcohol is a contributing factor in some of these assaults and harassments, especially when one of the recommendations is to stop justifying or excusing it. You wonder why the report still considers alcohol a contributing factor.
With that, it probably speaks specifically to people who live in residential colleges or the first couple of years of university when there is a lot of partying, there's hazing and those sorts of behaviours that, again, create an environment where the behaviours are more likely to eventuate. So there's a responsibility to actually provide training, to really think when we're planning these events to minimise any potential for this behaviour to occur, but then to make very clear the repercussions of not being respectful about harassing or assaulting people and what will come out of that. So while alcohol is a factor, there are a significant range of other factors that are contributing here. It shouldn't just be down to alcohol.
In other words, we shouldn't contribute to victim blaming by putting the onus back on people to protect themselves by, say, not getting too drunk.
Yeah, absolutely. And victim blaming is a serious problem with sexual violence. And it comes down to those attitudes and behaviours as well.
The incoming president of the Human Rights Commission says we need support from bystanders in these instances.
Yeah, absolutely. And the very low rate of bystanders who actually reported or gave support to the person that they saw being sexually harassed or assaulted was so low. And that's terrifying. One of the reasons or one of the main reasons why they didn't report was because they didn't feel like it was severe enough. And that lends itself to this other attitude that, perpetrators of rape or sexual assault are a stranger who jumps out of the bush and attacks you. But that's just not true. It could be a classmate or a supposed friend. And those kind of cultural attitudes have led to the downplaying and silencing of this issue. So we really need to unpack that in order for more bystanders to stand up and say, you know, there is actual zero tolerance. This is not okay. And I will take action.
Universities Australia says it's going to employ an external body to give what it describes as sexual ethics training to key campus leaders. Is that going far enough?
There's a lot that the universities need to do. They need to implement reporting systems. They need support programs to actually support and counsel survivors in a space that suits their needs. And then they need education and prevention programs, training around consent, especially people in leadership positions and within the colleges. There's a range of things that universities all need to take on board. It is positive to see the recommendations that have come out of the Human Rights Commission, and we've welcomed the 10-point plan from UA. It's really positive. But now what's important is, you know, it's not just words. It's taken seriously and actions happen. So today is just the first step in a very, very long road ahead.
That's Sophie Johnston from the National Union of Students speaking with Colin Tyrus.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
The culture of silence around sexual assault is perpetuated and reinforced by the lack of access to reporting services and a persistent narrative of a victim's experience not being seen as serious enough to warrant support, or the perpetrator being someone in a position of authority over the victim. This is by no means a problem unique to university campuses.
At the launch of the report, Commission President Rosalind Croucher spoke of the need for wider culture change to occur in order to fully support victims and minimise instances of sexual assault and harassment. Lara and Dina Curry spoke to Professor Jane de Hollander, Vice-Chancellor of Deakin University, about their responses to the report's findings.
Thank you for your interest in what is a very, very serious matter for universities and for the community as a whole.
We saw a copy of the email that you sent out to your staff today, just letting them know not only the results, but also the importance of this. What's it like on a university level when you see results like this and see what students have to engage with?
Look, you know, this is a line in the sand for us. You know, we're a big university, 56,000 students, 7,000 staff over a number of campuses. And we do keep very close touch with what happens on the campus. But, of course, you only ever manage those matters that come to your attention. What this line in the sand across the whole of Australia has done is give us hard data about sexual harassment and hard data about sexual assault. Sexual harassment is not okay. Sexual assault is a criminal matter. Now we have data that we can now realign our priorities and say, well, here is where the problems are. At Deakin, we can see that there's with harassment, that some of the places harassment occurs, public transport, getting to the campus is an issue for us. What are we doing about that? We know that some of our walkways and those sorts of places is where these things can happen. What are we doing? Do we have enough cameras? Do we have enough light? Though with staff, it's not okay for students to harass other students. What are we doing to make sure that all of our students understand about respectful behaviour in shared spaces and in making sure that they don't persistently offend someone else? It's absolutely unacceptable for staff in any way to sexually harass the students. You know, what are we doing to make sure that all of our staff know what is acceptable behaviour and what the line in the sand is and which you cannot cross? So that data is enabling us to do that, making sure that our GLBTIQ people are absolutely respected for who they are and are equal in the community and are not picked on for reasons of difference. That's what this data is enabling us to do.
It's certainly giving us the figures and the facts, but I guess from a university level, what is it that you can do next? Like, what are the steps that you guys would think about taking?
Okay, next step for us is consent matters. We have a very nice little app that we've developed. You know, a lot of people actually don't know what harassment is. Oh, look, it was only a joke. Well, you know, jokes by the person who gives them is not the point. It's who receives the joke. Oh, look, I only patted her bottom twice. You know, that's sexual harassment if the person has asked you to stop and you persist. Constant emails. So getting people to do some of the training, doing the training in very accessible ways, so using very modern app-like devices. Here are five questions. You know, do them. You need to do them. What's been interesting is how many of our students, over 2,000 students in the last week, have done the consent app. And I think that's interesting. Part of it is the publicity around that. My personal view is all staff, anyone who works in a university should do that so that they absolutely understand from all perspectives of the community they serve, students and other staff, what is the definition of harassment, particularly sexual harassment, and why it's not okay. Probably we'll make that compulsory to make sure that we absolutely have prevention of sexual harassment in all of the places where Deakin operates.
You did mention
that's one example. Oh, there's lots of other things, but that's not, you know, for your listeners, you don't want to bore them to death. Our website, there's many, many, many other things that we will do alongside this. But that's a particular pertinent one at the moment because it gets to everyone and everyone does the same thing. Students do it, staff do it. They all see it from the same lens.
So one of the problems with instances of sexual assault being underreported on campus was that a lot of people didn't know how to make those reports. Are you putting anything in place to make it easier for people to put in complaints, particularly against staff or people in positions of power over them?
Yeah. Absolutely. So one, I think that is an issue. Now, we've always had policies. We, in fact, have just refreshed, because we've had a year to work on all of this, knowing that there'll be data. We've refreshed all of our policies, but what we have done is lift everything right up the website from where it was buried into a frontline place on the website. What we have done, which I think is the most effective thing, but time will tell, is we have informed and trained 350 of our frontline people. What I mean by that is staff who are the most likely to deal with students and other staff who are wanting to ask for information or to complain or to report something, to give them the advice they need about how to ensure that they're compassionate and helpful to victims. You know, if you're coming to, you know, you'll be upset if you want to talk about someone who's harassed you sexually or and a sexual assault. You don't want someone to say, look, I first have to get the form before I can deal with you. You have to manage the victim in a compassionate and supportive way and go through the process. So we've upgraded our website so people can find things. That's often where people go. We have phone lines. There's a 24/7 number that people can call. And our 350 staff are in the process of increasingly deep training to be sufficiently confident to deal with these matters and to manage victims particularly and, of course, survivors if these are people who have happened to before. I'm very aware that some people may have not been given the support they needed in the past because we were incompetent or inept, and I'm really sorry about that. And if they want to come forward now, I hope that we will be able to do it better for them. 649 Deakin students filled in that survey. You know, we thank them. I'm really sorry to those who are reporting assault or harassment that happened to them while they were at Deakin. But if we can write things or improve things for them, I hope that they'll come forward.
Well, it sounds like you're making some great strides toward that. You mentioned trying to look after the LGBT community in Deakin.
Yes.
The report that came from the Human Rights Commission didn't have any specific recommendations around that, despite trans and gender diverse people being at the most risk. What specifically is Deakin going to be doing around that?
So in our report, there is nothing on GLBTIQ because the data sample was too small for Deakin. So there must have been less than 30 responses, as I understand it. So we have no data. However, what is absolutely true from people like yourselves, people in the wider community and the reports, we do know that people are often picked on for being different, and sexuality is exactly one of those things, and we need to be more specific. We have quite a significant group of people at Deakin who work particularly with our gay communities and our transgender communities, and one of our next steps is to consult with them in a much more detailed way to make sure what are your needs and where are we not serving you well. And this survey has allowed that line in the sand to say, look, it's obviously something going on. Just because there's not enough rigorous data doesn't mean we shouldn't go and talk to people and say, so how is it for you? You know, what can we do at Deakin to improve your experience on our campus or in our cloud? I think we now have a legitimate right to ask that question, to find the answers and then to act on it. Our campuses are broadly very, very safe places, but that's not the point. Broadly safe means at the edges, we need to make sure that everyone's safe. That's the aim now. How do we get to prevention? How do we make harassment not okay and prevent sexual assault?
If you found any of that content distressing, you can contact support services like Beyond Blue on 1300 224 636, or for specific support around sexual assault, call 1-800-RESPECT on 1-800-967-877. We'll put those numbers up on the Informer's Facebook page and underneath our podcast download.
This is The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter.
Now, our community is consistently reported to be at higher risk for health problems, mental illness and addictions, both due to the extra stresses the community faces and also the lack of access to health resources.
National and international data report that LGBTQIA groups are more likely to smoke and that rates are not coming down as fast as for much of the rest of the population.
Today, 1st of August, new regulations have come into effect across Victoria, which restrict smoking from all outdoor dining areas when food is available for consumption. Tonight, we ask how the changes will impact our community and venues. We have on the line Dr. Sarah White, who's Director of Quit Victoria. Welcome, Sarah.
Oh, thanks very much for having me, Ian.
Tell us about the new law that's coming in today. What does it actually mean?
So the new laws coming in today mostly will affect people around where they can smoke outside if other people are eating around them. So this new smoke-free legislation means that people can't smoke where food is being served in outdoor areas.
Because what's the thinking behind the change in the law?
So what happens every time we have this sort of smoke-free legislation, it has an effect in a few different ways. So the first one is it denormalises smoking for adolescents who might be tempted to take up smoking. If they don't see it as socially and culturally acceptable and it's something that people do when they go out, they're far less likely to take it up. The second thing is, of course, it protects people from exposure to secondhand smoke and just the pure amenity of being able to dine in smoke-free areas. It's, you know, people don't want to have smoke around them while they're eating. But most importantly, probably, it helps people who are trying to quit to say quit. So smokers tell us that one of the most difficult things when they're trying to quit is seeing or smelling or even hearing a cigarette lighter go off they're trying to manage their own cravings and urges. So that smoke-free legislation, if people go out, they go to somewhere that's smoke-free and it helps them keep motivated and helps support them to stay off the cigarettes.
So in those licensed areas, if people are just drinking, can they still smoke?
Yes, they can. That's probably a little bit of the legislation we hoped would be stronger because what it is allowing is publicans or venue owners to say, right, we're going to designate this as a smoking and drinking area. And we know that a lot of people who try to quit get tripped up when they drink alcohol and they start smoking more or they relapse back to smoking if there's alcohol involved.
And that's so that the law that's going to be in place in Victoria is more like Tasmania and New South Wales. Is that right?
It's very similar to New South Wales. I think that's probably the closest. So a venue can choose to have a smoking and drinking area and no food can be served, or they can serve food and then it's no smoking. It actually gets a little bit confusing for customers sometimes. We do know in New South Wales there have been a few venues that have said, well, okay, before 10, you can drink coffee and smoke. Between 10 and 12, you can eat but not smoke. And then, so they have different times of the day around when you can eat and when you can smoke, which isn't helpful, really.
But if food is being cooked or eaten in an open space, then there are restrictions in place. So it might get confusing, as you say, sometimes, depending on the time of day.
Look, what we're seeing is most venues are saying community expectation is very clearly that there is no smoking when people are eating, and even smokers tell us they don't like people smoking around them while they're eating. So we're hopeful that most venues are just going to say, look, let's just make this no smoking for the enjoyment of everybody.
Now, in the LGBTI population, we've got at least national and international data that suggests several of those groups are much, much more likely to smoke, and the rates are really not coming down nothing like as fast as they are for the rest of the populations. We don't really think it's going to be that different in Victoria. What difference do laws like this make for populations where, you know, there's still a lot of people smoking?
Yeah, look, it's a really interesting question, Ian. You're absolutely right. The smoking rates are higher in LGBTI communities, and that's a real concern for us and something we'd love to be doing something about. These sorts of laws...
What is happening in this space? Is Quit doing anything in that space at the moment?
No, we're not actually doing a lot in this space at the moment. It's something we desperately want to change. Because
right.
I'll tell you why. We know that a lot of the policies that affect tobacco consumption and smoking prevalence affect the entire population, irrespective of anything. You pay the same high cost of cigarettes. You are not exposed to advertising on the television. You do see the mass media campaigns on television. So the population level measures do help everybody across the community. But what I would really like to be doing is, and we've been talking a bit with Cancer Institute New South Wales, who's done this with ACON in Sydney, is to actually work more with the community to say, how can we, are there any specific barriers to reaching out for help to quit? We know people want to quit just as much as anyone in like the mainstream. What can we do to help break down those barriers to get out there and use those evidence-based supports and support each other? So it's really around an engagement, I think.
Yeah. So you think there's more that could be done in the LGBTI space?
Yes, I do. I do, absolutely, in Victoria. Yes, and we're desperately keen to do that.
Great, great, great to hear.
Well, I highly recommend anyone to go and look at their Smoke Free and Still Fierce campaign. It's brilliant. It's so funny and it's so good. So just Google Smoke Free, Still Fierce on the ACON website. It's just terrific. And, you know, I'd love to steal some of their ideas.
Great.
Or even work for better Victorian ones. How's that?
We have on the line Karen Price, who is Deputy CEO from ACON. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ian. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Is smoking an issue for the LGBTI population?
It absolutely is. And it's been an issue that has really been persistent over the last 10 or more years. Smoking in the LGBTI community has not reduced at the same rate as we've seen in the reductions for the general population, and that's a big concern.
So within the rainbow, which groups are you focusing on and what are you doing?
Yeah, with ACON, we've been advocating more broadly for policy inclusion, for example, for LGBTI people in our smoking policies. So the New South Wales, the new tobacco strategy for New South Wales, we're very hopeful that LGBTI people will be listed as a priority population, okay. And that's really important. So at the policy level, we've been advocating. We've also done some specific work for women with the New South Wales Cancer Institute through our Smoke Free, Still Fierce program.
It seems like a lot of people would pick up a smoking habit when they're quite young. Do you think it's worth targeting youth, particularly in the queer community?
Absolutely. We have some statistics that demonstrate, for example, women attached to the LGBTI community in Sydney, for example, are smoking at roughly 43%, and that's a rate that has not declined in 10 years. The rate in the general population is more like 13%. And we do believe that there's a link between smoking and identity. So this idea that LGBTI people are often marginalised, stigmatised, they're struggling with their mental health, they could be potentially having issues with their family and other relationships, and they're surrounded by smoking peers, means that, you know, it's not surprising that a number of those young people take up smoking. I can't speak for Victoria, but I know that New South Wales, we're struggling sometimes to maintain spaces for our communities. So for those spaces where our communities do gather, smoke-free zones in those spaces may, in fact, be another deterrent for people to actually go to those spaces. But I guess they'll be monitoring in place in Victoria. Overall, I think it's a good thing. And ultimately, our communities will need to make some choices about hopefully cutting down their tobacco when they're out in those spaces, which, as I said, is probably a good thing.
That's it for another episode of The Informer. We'll be back tomorrow at 6:30. If you'd like to let us know your thoughts on any of these stories, contact us on The Informer's Facebook, our Twitter, or email us at onair.joy.org.au.
A podcast of tonight's Informer will be available to download soon at joy.org.au or your preferred podcast platform. Or if you'd like to let us know your thoughts on any of tonight's stories, contact us on The Informer's Facebook, our Twitter, or email us.
We'd like to thank tonight's guests Sophie Johnston, Vice-Chancellor Jane de Hollander, Dr. Sarah White, and Karen Price. We'd like to thank our extended Informer team for putting tonight's show together.
My name is Ian Muchamore.
And I'm Lara Dickinson. Coming up next on Joy 94.9 is the news, followed by World Wide Wave.